Well, welcome everyone. This is obviously not Matt Shea, but this is Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of Free Washington, Spokane Valley, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, while illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Western Judeo-Christian civilization, it will be reality and not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. Remember, this is primarily a spiritual battle, folks. In Ephesians 6:12, it says, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." And remember, this program is brought to you by the Committee to Elect Matt Shea, Republican. Today, we have a guest that is quite well acquainted with Representative Shea. He is a Christian patriot, businessman, legislator, and he is a former member of the Washington State House of Representatives. He's been involved in public banking, investment banking, been the CEO, most recently, of a public company. He's actually done 20 or 25 campaign schools for Christian candidates running for the legislature. He actually got involved in his first congressional campaign way back in 1968. Folks, that's a half a century ago. Well, I would like to welcome to Patriot Radio, Mr. Glenn Dobbs. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be here. Gosh, you make it sound like I'm 100 years old, but I am closing in on that date.
Well, you know, us young folks are really have somebody to look up to in you, Glenn.
Well, thank you. I've been around the political arena for a good number of years, Jim. My first experience was in 1968 when a group of us decided very arrogantly that the state of Washington needed to be changed, as well as the U.S. Congress. And so we came together and recruited five candidates. At that time, Washington State had only five congressional districts. And so we actually ran five campaigns simultaneously in 1968. And it was kind of like the fellow whose eyes are bigger than his appetite's bigger than his capacity. And we didn't win one, but we had a lot of fun and I think educated a lot of people.
You were probably fairly new to politics at the time, weren't you?
Well, I was at Western Washington University at the time and was president of the Young Republicans. And then toward the end of my career at that school, I was at the same time was president of the Young Republicans and the Young Democrats. We won't go into that story here, but it was one of my brighter moments, suffice to say.
So we're going to talk about Representative Matt Shea today. And since this is brought to you by his campaign and his election committee, I think instead of bringing other types of guests on, I wanted to bring on somebody that knew Matt well. And because not as enough is known about the struggles and the victories and the defeats, and really the average person, I believe, has little idea of just how difficult it can be to be a state representative, especially when you're a man of principle. So I would like to kind of get into that today and see who this guy, Matt Shea, really is, as the man would say. And how'd you meet Matt? How'd you come across this guy, this Matt Shea guy?
I was introduced to Matt a little over 10 years ago, I believe. A lady called me at work one day and said that she had met a young man who had some very well-defined ideas about liberty, the Constitution, the history of this country, and she would like to get us together. So we met, and then over time, I found that Matt was exactly as represented, and we ended up serving on the board of an organization here in Spokane briefly. And then at one point, Matt expressed an interest in possibly running for office. And so I was privileged to be able to help him out a little bit in the early years of his legislative experience. I should point out, Jim, that this is, you know, at the time I was running a public company, and as CEO of a public company, you're busy with most of your waking hours, but recognizing in Matt a young man of extraordinary integrity who based his entire lifestyle on principle and had the courage to stand by those principles. And I decided this is someone that I would enjoy working with. And so I became involved very peripherally in his first campaign, and have since followed his progress through his 10 years or so in the legislature, in the House. And I have to say, Matt has never disappointed me. He is one of those rare people in the political arena today who, when he makes a statement and he takes a position on an issue, it's a well-thought-out position, and until he finds or receives information to the contrary, he maintains that position regardless of the difficulties and the criticisms that might bring.
So would you say then that his Christian faith has been really foundational to how he has been conducting himself in the legislature?
Well, very definitely. We, you know, in the legislature, as well as at the county level, moving on up to the congressional level, and even the president's office, there is no shortage of people who profess to be Christians of one stripe or another. But in among the political class, it's really extraordinary to find someone who actually conducts himself in the political arena in a way that conforms or comports with his professed beliefs, and with an eye toward performing in a way that would glorify God and would set an example for others who would like to emulate his work. So Matt has always carried his beliefs, his Christian beliefs, and his standards out in public. I would not describe him as a zealot. You know, we've met people who would have a special Bible made up with extraordinarily large letters on the front of it, B-I-B-L-E, so that the TV cameras could pick it up as they are filmed going into a church. I mean, we saw that with one of our previous presidents, primarily. That would be the Clintons, of course. But in Matt's case, he doesn't do that. He isn't out there grabbing people by the throat and telling them that they have to convert to his position or even accept his position. He just very quietly goes about his work and lets his work define his beliefs and illustrate where he stands.
Would you say that humble people usually don't honk their own horn enough? They usually don't bring these kinds of things up to their detriment. Would you say that?
Well, certainly. I mean, we have approximately 20 people who are standing on the dais running for vying for the Democrat nomination for President of the United States. And at one time or another, all of them have professed their spiritual commitments, and mostly even Christianity. But at the same time, those people are singing their own praises to high heaven, which is a figure of speech, but singing their own praises, but at the same time advocating abortion on demand and legalization of drugs and the various perverse lifestyles and that sort of thing. But I found that Matt, once again, just goes his way and does his thing. And when the barbs and arrows come from the other side, he just keeps on going and does his job.
If this sounds like a little bit like an infomercial, I'm not going to apologize, because really it is. And the next question that really comes to mind is how then is Matt different? How does he compare to others in the political realm, those who maybe are what they call a Republican name only, a rhino, or those who, I'll just toss that one to you, Glenn. How would you contrast him to others?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues inherent in that question. One would be Matt's fundamental beliefs in that God created man, and in so doing gave man the right and the will to make decisions on his own. And God gave us the opportunity to live lives of freedom, both spiritually and in our everyday lives with other people around us. I think Matt has committed his career or careers from the time he served in the Army as a captain in the Army and right up until today as a member of the Washington State House of Representatives, has committed himself to striving to roll back the regulatory tidal wave that has come upon this country over the last 50 or 60 years. And so Matt has devoted himself to a struggle for freedom, restoring freedom, both at the state level and the federal level. I don't know how widely known it is, but Matt travels a great deal around the country and actually even internationally, carrying the message of freedom. And the effect of that has been profound in a number of different venues. I think this concept of freedom, Jim, is something that is diametrically juxtaposed or opposed by this concept of socialism that we hear so much about today. Again, returning to the 20 people vying for the Democrat nomination, virtually all of them have at one time or another, and most of them very publicly, have admitted to being socialists and advocating a socialist way of life in this country. And frequently they hold up the countries of Scandinavia to illustrate the socialist utopia that we could expect once we adopt their policies. But I've traveled throughout Scandinavia over the years, and I find that utopia does not exist, and it makes no difference whether you're going to Norway, Finland, Denmark, Sweden. They're not socialist utopias. In fact, most of those countries today have very publicly and forthrightly stated that they are not socialist countries. that they are market countries. And while there's an element of truth in that, the fact remains that they took great pride in their socialism up until the last 4 or 5 years. But I think we have to look at what socialism really is in its reality, not from the standpoint of a PR or political pontification, but in reality, what is socialism? And socialism really is rule of a population by a very small elitist group that largely controls the political structure and the economic structure of a country. For example, if you take a look at Norway or Denmark or Sweden, you'll find that in those countries that are held up as something we ought to emulate, those countries are largely, each one of them, controlled by anywhere from 5 or 6 to 8 families, very wealthy families, that exert a huge influence over their political system and thusly are well positioned to garner the contracts for road construction, airport construction, seaport construction, and that sort of thing.
So it tends to concentrate the wealth into a small group rather than building a middle class.
Exactly. And the result of that is the destruction of the middle class. And so returning to Matt's perception of liberty versus the various alternatives, Matt understands this, and he and I have spent a fair amount of time talking about this over the years, as much as his busy schedule would permit. And he understands the essence, the very essence of freedom lies in small government, as envisioned by the founders of this country. And of course, the statists, that is the socialists, if you will, want to take it just exactly the opposite direction and give us as much government as we possibly can, of course, from which they reap the benefits themselves. And we have any number of examples of that, not the least of which is our own governor, Jay Inslee, who is a firm believer in statist or socialist government. And we've seen that in his policies here since he first came into office about 7 years ago.
He has become quite the champion for the environmental movement, hasn't he?
Well, he has. And I think not only has not played well for him, it made him look rather foolish when he had declared his candidacy for the presidency and appeared in his first debate, in which I don't want to be too demeaning of our governor, but he came across as a punch drunk person who was committed to a single issue, the objective of which was to establish massive controls over every facet of American people's lives, and that is through his radical positions on so-called protecting the environment, which we all know now, I think, is just pure foolishness.
And to say nothing of the fact that he was redefining what a long-shot candidate really is, because there was somewhere between little and no chance that he would ever be a viable candidate for president. But anyways, what you were doing was really describing the essence of the conflict between the collective, between that which we saw in the Soviet Union, which we see in China and places like Cuba now, versus a country in which the individual has individual rights before God, in which the individual has all the power in the government. And you mentioned that Matt is having a national impact right now as he's speaking all over the country, and indeed a ministry takes him to other parts of the world as well. But I remember I spent the first 6 years with him as his LA, and I remember one of the first bills that he introduced was House Joint Memorial 4009, which was basically a 10th Amendment bill. And there was almost nothing out there at the time similar to this. And of course, House Joint Memorial did not go anywhere legislatively in the House. But even though it didn't receive any legislative action, it did receive a lot of play in the alternative media. InfoWars picked it up, gave him a lot of airtime. Even Coast to Coast AM had him on. And that covers the whole country. And all of a sudden, his email account just exploded. And we got hundreds of supportive emails from all over the country singing the praises of Matt Shea. Thank you for standing up and taking the lead. And really what it was a definition, really, of a leader in taking a position like that, because few people in politics would have thought that anything like that would have any purpose, that it was useless to introduce a bill like that. But it got the conversation started. You need someone of courage to step forward and propose a bill like that to even start the conversation. So I remember that very well because I was that poor stiff that was behind the computer answering all those emails. And I got to tell you, there were hundreds of them. So we've compared him to our pitiful governor, and look at Bob Ferguson, I mean, our attorney general. I mean, another example of a politician who has punished those who are speaking out for freedom. It was the attorney general who sued the flower vendor in the Tri-Cities. And so what other examples of Matt's integrity comes to your mind, Glenn? Is there something else that?
Well, I think the contrast, as you mentioned, between Governor Inslee and his Attorney General Bob Ferguson and Matt is very appropriately drawn because we see in the governor a compulsion to dictate to the people of the state of Washington his own values, such as they are, his own political ideology, such as it is. And then we've seen, certainly through the Attorney General's office, his willingness, Ferguson's willingness, to use his office to impose his personal views and proclivities on the rest of the people in the state of Washington. And the one thing that you'll find that's consistent throughout this radical element within the political class is their intolerance of other people's views, which runs just counter to the tolerance that is practiced by conservatives and Christians across the state as well as across the country. This concept of force is something, is the male fist, the mailed fist of the power seekers who seek to achieve office, public office, for their own benefit and to benefit their families. And, you know, we have seen so many examples of this over the years, Jim, that, and even just recently, where people at the state level and the federal level use their office to benefit themselves or their families financially.
Hunter Biden comes to mind.
Former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter is a classic example. And, of course, they pretend that on a 12-hour flight from the U.S. to China, that the son never discussed his business dealings in China with the father, but he came home and 10 or 15 days later received a check for $1.5 billion to go into his private equity fund, which just if you just look at the commissions that are earned through private equity funds, that would have a value to Hunter Biden of something somewhere between $3 million and $5 million personally to him and the other owners of his fund. So we see this not just appearance of wrongdoing, but wrongdoing and the desire to line their own pockets by this radical left political class. But at the same time, Matt is working as an attorney in Spokane. He carries a huge load, speaking load, across the state and across the country, and even beyond, because I believe he was speaking in Eastern Europe just a week or 10 days ago at an invitation of a political group over there, as I recall. And so he is literally is giving the whole of his life to the cause for freedom. This, that, by the way, is the title of a book, The Whole of Their Lives by Benjamin Gitlow, who was a member of the Communist Party back in the 30s and 40s, in which he described how the left, the radical left, the socialist communist wing of the radical left, demands that their people devote their entire lives to that movement. And that's what you're seeing today in the legislative halls at the state level as well as the national level. People who are occupying those seats in the legislature and Congress who really have never done anything in their lives except feed at the public trough in one way or another, and they have so established themselves within the political class that it's, you know, it's seriously, it makes one seriously wonder if there's anything that these people could do if they were pushed out of that class, which explains why that they fight to the death, figuratively and almost literally, to maintain those positions. So I'm just so pleased with Matt. You know, he's a he's a lot younger than I am. He could be my son. And I'm just so proud of him because he, because of his stands and his integrity in the face of just unbelievable opposition from those who would do him in at the local level to the state level and even beyond. So I think, you know, I'm just very proud of him. And that probably comes through in everything that I say. But I think Matt is a fine young man, a man of integrity. And I just wish that we had more and pray that we will have more.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree, Glenn. I am so proud of Matt, especially being able to stand strong in the face of withering opposition sometimes to principles he knows are sound and correct and true. I remember in the first few years, I would notice that new members of the House might sponsor one, maybe two bills in their first session. And then I reflected back on Matt, who came right in, sat down, and introduced 21 bills under his own hand during the first session, and probably had signed on to as a secondary sponsor probably twice that many of bills that he deemed worthy of his support. So this is a sign, this is a characteristic of a true leader, someone who's not afraid to take a stand for what is right, and then not back down when he gets a little bit of opposition.
Jim, if I may interject here, I think you've hit on a very important point. All of us, I think, have been at a meeting or many meetings in which the established political establishment is up front, or whether it's a school board meeting or a meeting of a public meeting that's called by the Forest Service or Bureau of Land Management or the Washington State Department of Ecology, in which they call the meetings just to allow the public an opportunity to kind of vent their frustrations. And we sit in that meeting, and there might be 40 or 50 or maybe 140, 150 people in the meeting. And everyone just sits silently. And we've all seen this. And then all of a sudden, one person stands up and expresses their opposition to what's being done. And then the next thing you see is someone else pops up, and then someone else pops up. But in those meetings in which there's no one to stand up and speak out initially, the meetings just go on, and everybody walks away frustrated, and very frustrated with the governmental entity that sponsored the meeting, and knowing that it's going to be crammed down their throat.
And knowing that if they had stood up,
yes,
possibly knowing that if they had stood up and just said something,
right,
that it could have come out so differently.
That's right. They go home saying, why didn't I stand up? Why didn't I speak out? Well, there are many reasons why people don't do that. But then there's, very frequently, there's the one person who's done his homework, who's given the subject matter a lot of thought, and stands up and speaks out and expresses his opposition to the policy that's being set. And then all of a sudden, he finds that there are many, many people behind him. And then when the meeting is over, everyone gathers out in the foyer, and they start talking about they need to form an organization, or they need to put together a petition or something like that. And it works the same way in the legislature. So frequently, our Republican friends in the House and the Senate are waiting for someone to stand up for what's right, to state it articulately and express their conviction on why the action that is being proposed is not in the public's best interest, or is in many instances a violation of the state or the national constitution, and certainly a violation of the morals and mores of our society. And I've seen that so many times with people in the legislature, legislatures across the country, where one person is courageous and stands up, and all of a sudden he has people who are following him. He introduces a bill that's designed to alleviate some problem, and instead of having his signature being the only one on the bill, he's able to go around and pick up 20, 25, or 30 co-sponsors of the bill. And that's where Matt has been so incredibly effective, I think, in the Washington State House of Representatives. And I think, I would love to see that kind of integrity at other levels across the state, certainly in the governor's office, because we so sorely need that kind of leadership instead of the leadership that we see now that is clearly designed to drag this state down lower than where it has come just in the last 10 years.
Leading us down that same pathway as cities like Detroit, Baltimore, and Seattle have gone, with exploding homeless populations, and they've really become kind of like rat's nests.
Well, they have, but this is something else that I think is really worth examining, and it points up the contrast between those who are advocates of individual liberty as well as government responsibility. We talk a lot about liberty, but not so much is said about responsibility. But you'll probably remember, Jim, and I think you're old enough to remember this, back in the early 1970s, a move developed across the country to close the mental institutions, clear across the country, in virtually every state. And the state of Washington closed down most of its mental institutions. I think we have two or three left, one over the one in Medical Lake, and then the other over in Western Washington.
Yeah, they closed two in Western Washington, the one in Cedar Woolley, and the one down towards Olympia.
Yes, yeah. And these were large institutions, and these were institutions that were used to help people who were having psychological, emotional difficulties, some of whom were a danger to society, the criminally insane. But the decision was made in the early 1970s to throw all these people, close the institutions and throw these people out on the streets. On the mistaken idea that they could then be integrated into society. Well, the reality is that many people with mental disorders cannot be integrated into society. And we're seeing that across the country now, and in and particularly in some of our major cities. As a matter of fact, Jim, as I was getting off of the freeway this afternoon here in Spokane, I saw what appeared to be just a bundle of blankets on the exit ramp over next to the curb. And I just assumed that it was something that had blown off of a car or a truck. And as I went by, I looked down and there was a person wrapped up in those blankets lying 2 or 3 feet from the wheels of these vehicles that were coming off at 50 and 60 miles an hour.
Just inches from cars and trucks' wheels that are going by.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's important to understand that the conditions that we're seeing in our cities today are not the result of just bad policy. They're the result of intentional policy. And I realize that this is going to be very controversial to some ears, but the reality is that all of these cities are run by radical left-wing individuals. And this is being done with intent and forethought. I mean, how could you possibly ruin the central areas of these cities the way they have been ruined and end up with this massive homeless population?
I mean, Seattle is known as the Emerald City. I mean, it's a beautiful city and a beautiful location. But recently there was a video short that was produced. I guess it wasn't a short. I guess it was almost an hour long. It was called Seattle is Dying. And it underscored the really severe problems that they're having in the city of Seattle with the drugs, the public drugs, public defecation and urination right on the street in front of everyone. Pursue that just a little bit.
Well, this used to be relegated to what they call Skid Row in Seattle, which was really down around First Avenue. But I was speaking with a couple of former members, one of the House and one of the Senate, just last week about this. I don't live in Seattle anymore. I spent the better part of 24 or 5 years in the Puget Sound area, but live in Eastern Washington now. And I asked them, when you go to downtown Seattle, what do you see up around 3rd, 4th, 5th Avenue, which is, of course, the financial district and where the nice restaurants and hotels.
Columbia Tower is on 4th or 5th, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And they said that one of them said the last time she was down there, they were sitting at a traffic signal and a fellow was standing on the corner, bent over, defecating in the street. And this was on either 4th or 5th Avenue, I don't remember which. But this is something that is the result of conscious policies and decisions made by city government and county government. I think probably the most stark and striking example of this would be Chicago, where on any given weekend there will be 25 or 30 shootings in Chicago and anywhere from 5 to 8 or 9 people killed. Now, we hear this and we read about it in the newspapers and see it on television, but it's just very casually mentioned. But very seldom do we hear anyone ask, why does this happen? Why is this allowed to happen? And I think there are any number of answers to that question, but the bottom line is this could not be happening in Chicago without the acquiescence of the city fathers, because they certainly have the wherewithal to put a stop to that. And I think there are two outstanding answers to that question, I think are very stark answers. One is that is predominantly that those killings, that shooting and killing, is occurring primarily in the Black and the Latino communities in Chicago. And the other is that much of it is drug related. It's warfare between cartels or people trying to get into the cartels. But however you describe it, the fact of the matter is that that could not happen without the acquiescence of the city fathers, and the same answer has to fall at the feet of the elected officials in the cities of Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Detroit, and so on. So this can be cleaned up, but it is not going to be cleaned up as long as the people in these cities continue to elect people who have this statist, socialist attitude, which allows them to achieve a position of power for their own benefit, and basically to hell with the rest of the world.
You brought up a very interesting topic here, and I think that Matt has been an extraordinarily staunch supporter of the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms in Washington State. And of course, the Washington State Constitution has a very strong statement on the right to keep and bear arms, as does our U.S. Constitution. Up to the time of the Heller decision, it was always the subject of word games in trying to pervert the real meaning of the Second Amendment. But they, during that decision, they did establish that it was an individual right. But under the gun issue, it brings to mind these mass shootings that occur. And they always point to the gun. Well, they, the media, the liberal establishment, those who are, I suppose, opposed to individual freedom, point to the gun itself, and the gun is the problem. That piece of metal is really the problem here. And yet, I watched a video of, where'd my notes go? His name is Daryl Scott. His daughter Rachel was one of the victims in Columbine. And he presented this great little short testimony to the U.S. House Judiciary Subcommittee that it wasn't the gun, it was the person. When Cain killed Abel, it was the person that killed him. It wasn't the club, it wasn't the knife, it wasn't the gun. It was that evil in their heart that precipitated that event. And these mass shootings are they keep pointing to the gun, but that's not the situation. And I've heard a lot of testimony regarding those individuals in who have been on psychoactive drugs, have been most of the perpetrators of mass shootings, they said, were on psychoactive drugs of some kind, which are lots to choose from, I guess, today, as well as those people who really should have been. They had a history of mental problems that they should have been receiving help of some kind. You have any comment on that?
Well, just briefly, of course, what we're talking about here is a product of nationally, of our national program to just abandon the mentally ill in this country. Mm-hmm. And of course, along with mental illness comes a lack of spiritual orientation or spiritual foundation. They go hand in glove. And the radical left, and I don't just mean Democrats. I don't refer to the radical left as just being Democrats, because there are a lot of so-called Republicans that are aligned on this issue. They never fail to try to take advantage of this these mass shootings and the hysteria that they then can whip up around it and take advantage by demanding that the American people disarm. So, you know, this goes back to the old Hegelian dialectic of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. They have created this problem. And then as the problem develops, then they offer the solution to it. And the synthesis is fewer and fewer freedoms on the part of the American people to defend themselves.
So this is kind of the situation in which the laboratory that this problem was created in, they will offer up the antidote to that problem in the same laboratory, and that antidote is government.
Sure. It's like creating a poison, and then, of course, when you create a poison, the first thing you have to do is to come up with an antidote. But I think there's a question that has to be asked here. We've all heard a great deal about the opposition of the far left to firearm ownership in this country, and some of them have even gone so far as to advocate the repeal of the Second Amendment and so on. But the question that has to be asked is, why do these people want to disarm the American public? Why do they want to do that? Why do they want to take everyone's guns?
Why do they fear law-abiding people so much, Glenn?
Well, if you intend to establish yourself as the primary power holder in the country, it's a very, very risky position to aspire to, knowing that there are over 300 million firearms in the country. It's a very high-risk job, just like the Caesars of Rome. It was amazing the fall of the Roman Republic and the rise of the Roman Empire and the second, third centuries AD, that how vigorously generals and politicians would fight to become the next Caesar, knowing that in that political climate, that they might only last a month or two or three in the office. The lust for power is insatiable in those people who have it. And so I think, again, we have to ask this question, always ask this question: why do these people want to disarm the American public? The answer to that question is because it makes the American public very vulnerable to crime and to government fiat. And then once that happens, people cannot defend themselves. Then they have to look to the state or to the very politicians who brought this about for their own protection. And as long as you play the game and you're one of the insiders in the game and you're not creating a fuss and opposing any of their policies, you'll get the protection. But if you are opposing their policies, then that protection can be withdrawn and you have no means by which to protect yourself. So this is a very, very important point, I think, and it's something that all of us need to be asking ourselves. Why are they so focused on getting the American people's guns?
Excellent. And I thank you for that perspective, Glenn, because indeed, those countries, as you've seen all across the planet, who are disarmed, have no recourse in the event of a strong dictatorial government. You know, there's one other issue that Matt has been extremely on. Well, one of the many other issues that Matt has been quite strong on, and that's the issue of life and the issue of the preborn and those and the elderly. It is absolutely mind-bending to me to realize that there are over 60 million babies that have been sacrificed on the altar of convenience in the United States. And I know that Matt has been working legislatively to defund Planned Parenthood, who is the primary vendor of abortions the killing of the unborn in the United States. Not only does the federal government fund Planned Parenthood quite generously, but the state governments do almost universally, and that includes Washington State. Well, I can't recall, you have to forgive me, I am over 50 years old. Sometimes those would say considerably over 50, and I don't remember the exact dates. But there were times when Matt, as a leader, saw the opportunity in the legislature to defund Planned Parenthood, and one of those would only have required the Republican caucus to simply have a recorded vote, because he knew that there were Democrats in there, and they were voting on the budget, and the budget had an amendment sitting before it, and they were voting on this amendment, and he was asking that the caucus support the idea of calling for a recorded vote on that amendment. Usually amendments are a voice vote. If they had had a recorded vote, there were a lot of Democrats who live in districts that are pretty heavily pro-life, and they are looking over their shoulder. And he believes that it could have passed, but he was out there leading. But in that case, the caucus would not follow, and consequently, it failed. So, what are we going to do about this life issue, Glenn? I know Matt is doing everything that he possibly can in the legislature, every opportunity that comes before him, to make a difference for the cause of life. Where do we stand there?
Well, I'm very, very optimistic on this issue, Jim. The pendulum has swung in our favor on this over just the last 5 or 6 years. Incidentally, it should not be surprising that the radical left is the primary proponent of this. Of course, Margaret Sanger, who is the founder of Planned Parenthood, was a firm believer in eugenics to eliminate the black population in the United States, as well as the mentally challenged. And it's interesting that the left today just ignores the entire eugenics movement that Margaret Sanger founded in the United States, but at the same time, they are not willing to talk about the fact that more than 70% of the abortion clinics, the Planned Parenthood abortion clinics in the United States, are located in the largely black populated central areas of the cities. And so today, the left is carrying out the same eugenics program that Margaret Sanger originated back in the 1930s, and there's nothing said about it. But I do think that the pendulum has begun to swing. If we could now just encourage the people who should be on our side to display what I will call the anatomical wherewithal to stand up and take position on these issues. And I'm referring to you alluded to rhinos a little while ago. A rhino, by the way, is a Republican who, an elected official who lives in a Republican district. He's a Democrat or an extreme liberal, but he knows he couldn't get elected in that district if he ran as a Democrat, so he runs as a Republican. So the rhino, of course, refers to the Republican in name only. But if we could just get those people who should know better to stand up on this issue and give us the vote when these bills come up, as Matt has experienced in the Washington State House, we could clean this whole issue of abortion up, I think, probably in another 2 or 3 years. But again, Jim, I'm very encouraged about this. The pendulum has swung in our direction, and I think ultimately we're going to triumph over this. But let me just say is kind of my summary here.
Yeah, because we have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, I won't take the 2 minutes, but I just want to say that Matt Shea is a man of true integrity, a man of principle, and he lives his life according to those principles. And I am really just very, very thrilled to have him as a friend and to have played just a small part in returning him there. I don't know where he's going to go politically in his future. I think that higher office probably is in his future at some point. But in the meantime, God has blessed us with a godly man, and I think he's someone who's deserving of our attention and our support.
I say that his intelligence, I've watched him keep track of bills on the floor, especially when the speaker will change the order of presentation on the floor of the House, and he just goes crazy trying to keep up because he reads every bill. He reads it at least far enough to know that he's not going to support it. If he winds up reading the whole thing, it's usually for his support. How he keeps up with that, it takes a lot of intelligence. Courage to be a leader that he is, and the courage, too, to maintain the principles, Christian principles, that he lives every day. You know, I think electing Matt Shea is not an option. It is mandatory this time around. Matt will be back. For those of you who have missed him on Tuesday, this program, of course, is brought to you by the Committee to Elect Matt Shea. And indeed, this generation could be the greatest one.